Republic members.
Okay, if not, we'll move ahead to accept and file summary of actions for the June 4th meeting. Are there any changes to the summary? If not, we will accept and file those. The next item is approve proposed revisions to rule 426 architectural coding. And Mary is doing this. Need to unmute.
Song will be giving the presentation today.
Hello, everybody. Can you guys see my screen? Okay. Sure. Perfect. Good afternoon, the members of the advisory committee. My name is Song Kim. I'm the air quality engineer for the district. As you guys recall, previously, Mary gave you a presentation in regards to our Route 426 and told you that in September that we'll be coming to you back again to discuss these revisions that we're proposing to make. So here I will be doing that presentation for you guys. And so here will be the couple of items that I will be discussing in my presentation. I'll just give you a quick refresher of what Route 426 is. The changes made by the California Air Resources Board, also known as CARB, under suggested control measured, SCM for architectural codings that they did in 2019 and in 2020. Then we'll dive in deeper into what those changes will be made in our Route 426, the impacts from those changes, and the public comments that we receive during this period, and the schedule adoption date for board adoption. So what is architectural codings? They're basically codings that you apply to on your buildings or your home. Why do we care about these codings? It's when they are applied, an emission called volatile organic compounds, also known as VOCs, are emitted, and they are known to be precursors for both ozone and particulate matter. And as we know it, ozone can be very harmful to us. Based upon our 2012 data, architectural coatings are a large source of our VOC emissions. They accounted for about 2 tons per day and about 868 tons in a year. This is based on 2012, and you can see why we would need a route like this to control these VOC emissions. Who does the architectural coatings apply to? It's any person who supplies, sells, offer for sales, solicits the applications of any architectural coatings, or manufactures, blends, or repackages within our jurisdiction. The architectural coatings are controlled, the VOC emissions from these architectural coatings are controlled through Route 426 by limiting the VOC content of each coating, which is modeled after the state's SCM for architectural coatings. And one of the reasons why we would have to create this rule is because it is our obligation to comply with the state so that we adopt it. Every feasible measures to reduce VOC emissions. And by reducing VOC emissions, it will also help us progress in attaining both the federal and state ozone standards. So the state is an the California Air Resources Board is an oversight agency, and they also provide assistance to the air districts in California. And one of the ways that they do provide assistance is by creating a model rule, hence the suggested control measures. One of the key benefits of creating a suggested control measure is that it provides consistency and uniformity among all the different air districts in California, so that it makes it easier for manufacturers and painting contractors to comply with the district rules throughout California. So back in 2019, the state made some revisions to their suggested control measures. And in summary, what those changes were in 2019 were to lower the VOC limits for 9 coding categories and add 3 new coding categories and colorants to the list. And then for this year, what they have changed as well was to add this new photovoltaic coding category, which will be applied onto existing solar modules because it will provide better energy efficiency to the solar panels.
Excuse me, may I interrupt for a moment?
Yes.
Am I the only one that's hearing a fade in and fade out on the voice, or is it just me?
No, I'm having the same problem.
I don't know if it's going back and forth on the mic or what, but your voice fades away and then comes back and then fades away. I don't know if there's anything you can do about it at your end.
I see. Let me see here. Did anything change? Am I still coming in and out?
Well, right at the moment you are, but it was going back and forth. You'd be loud and then it would go to nothing practically, and then loud and then go back.
Okay.
It was really getting irritating to listen to.
Yeah. Is it good now? Is it still occurring?
So far. You're louder now. As long as it stays steady, we'll be good.
Okay. Additionally,
this view of the slides is better for me because the larger view goes into the participants list and I can't read the whole slide. So
I see. Okay.
Good.
Yeah, I could do this. And with that being said, do you guys want me to restart my presentation?
No.
Okay. I'll be moving on. That I just finished discussing about the 2020 changes. Let's see here. There we go. So now we'll get into the nitty gritty details of the changes that we're making to Roof 26. We're going to eliminate the non-flat high gloss coating category. We're going to remove and or modify outdated definitions and requirements. And then to address those 2019 revisions from the state, we're going to establish those new coding categories and VOC limits and establish the VOC limits also for the colorants. And then to address the 2020 revisions from the state, we're going to add a standalone section denoted as part 7 to address the photovoltaic coding categories and as well put in a new table to address those VOC limits for those for the photovoltaic coating. And then we're also going to update the sell-through provision language for the coatings and colorants and add a new term called market in the applicability section. So in this next slide here is to show you the proposed limits that we're going to be adopting for the coating categories. One thing to note is that the NA that you see there in the current limit, that is denoted as not applicable because those coatings did not exist in our current Roof 426. So we didn't have a current limit. But as you can see there in the second column, those are the current limits. And if you just look right by side to the proposed limits, you can see a significant reduction in the VOC limit. And the units are in grams per liter. And then as so forth, VOC limits for the colorants, like I said, NA because it didn't exist, and these will be the proposed limits for those appropriate coding, colorants. And then lastly, added a new table to address the photovoltaic coatings. For this one, it's going to be a little bit different. The proposed limit of 600 grams per liter. We have a max usage limit of 27 gallons per day. And there is also a sunset date for this coding category. I believe it's in January 1, 2028. So what are the admission benefits from these revisions? So if we adopt the 2019 revisions, we anticipate a VOC reduction for about 0.09 tons per day, which equates to about 33 tons in a year. And then if we adopt the 2020 revisions, we do see a one-time VOC increase of 0.068 tons per day, but that emission is offsetted because by putting on this better coating on the solar modules, we prevent the use of power plant emission, getting our power from the power plants, which would reduce their emissions. And based upon a 10-year lifetime project, we can anticipate the following reductions from the following pollutants. So for oxides of nitrogen over 10 years, we can see a reduction in 10.2, VOC 1.7, oxides of sulfur 0.6, particulate matter 3, carbon monoxide 19, and then carbon dioxide about 25,000. So during this rulemaking period, we did receive comments from the public. And the one that we did receive was from the state themselves. So they recommended that we updated the definitions on our flat coating to update the ASTM reference, recommend adding this language called for professional use on our labeling requirements, and then also recommend changing the language in section 6.53 to match their language in section 8.5 of their suggested control measure rule. We also received a comment from a gentleman named David Darling. He requests to add more labeling language for industrial coatings and retain the definition of non-flat high gloss, as his reasoning was that some manufacturers still use non-flat high gloss. So that is for clarity purposes for people subject to this rule. Diane Brickman asked about the eliminations of fire retardant definition. After review of her comment, we do agree that we should retain these definitions for clarity purposes, as there is a difference between fire resistive and fire retardant coatings. And then CARB suggested the removal of the anti-fouling coating from the list of our categories. However, we received a comment from Spencer Vartanian from Dynegy, which is the Moss Landing plant, to continue to have this anti-fouling coating category, which would lead to my next slide to discuss anti-fouling coatings. So what are anti-fouling coatings? They're basically specialized paints that you paint under the boats and ships and vessels that will prevent marine growth like sea barnacles and whatnot. And they're also applied inside of the pipes serving the cooling power plants systems to prevent biofouling. And the state removed this category back in 2012 in their 2012 revisions. However, we did receive during that time, the advisory committee at that time and the board at that time to continue to have the anti-fouling coating category. So if we do decide to remove this category based upon CARB's recommendation, the VOC limit of such anti-fouling coatings would be defaulted to our special coating, which is at 100 grams per limit of VOC. And to give you what the current limit is for our rule, it is 400 grams per liter of VOC limit. So based upon the comments from Spencer, staff will continue to retain the anti-fouling coating category unless directed otherwise. This is the schedule for our board adoption hearing. We plan on taking to the board in September 16, 2020. We are still taking public comments at this time. Public comments are due by September 7 at the end of the day, to ensure that it is included in the board package. And with that being said, that concludes my presentation. I will be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions?
I have a question.
Who is that?
That was me, Sandy Copeland.
Okay.
So I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
And my question is, you've shown us the positive results of this reduction in emissions, but what are the negatives? Will solar panels still provide as much energy with this reduction?
Well, that's the idea by applying this photovoltaic coating cutter. We're going to increase that efficiency by 3 to 4%. So if the solar panel or the existing modules do not decide to apply this coating, then I don't know what the efficiency is. I can't give you like the numbers of how much power is generated, but there is a benefit to this by increasing the efficiency.
The issue here was there was never a coating that would have allowed this. Without adopting this category, they would have been a specialty coating and it would have had to meet 150 grams per liter, and they would not have been able to use the coating to get that extra efficiency. So by creating this additional category, it's going to allow us to apply this coating on existing modules. This coating is already being applied at the factory now, but it was not available, 10 years ago when these older ones were installed. So that's why it has a sunset date, is we're only going to allow this coating for this short period of time to get those older solar modules painted to get that additional efficiency.
Are there other questions?
I had one. I was reading the attachment A, or trying to, and I got lost in the woods on kind of interpreting this. I was wondering if you could take a few lines of that and kind of go through it and interpret what each of the columns. You've got acute score, chronic score, cancer score, priority, and status. It was a little confusing. I tried to do my homework on it, but I was a little lost in the woods on it.
I think that's for the next presentation for Amy Kleimel for the AB 2588 update. So that does not pertain to Route 426.
I have a couple of questions. Because this is a suggested control measure, it's pretty much these limits have already been designed into statewide architectural coatings, is that correct?
Yes, correct.
So it's more or less a done deal, right? My other question relates to, you showed an emission inventory for architectural coatings that was dated 2012. Don't we have more current emission inventory data?
We may have.
Old.
Yes, that's just what is published on the state's website. So that's what I went off of. As far as the most updated one, I'm wondering if David Frisbee could comment on that, if we have any more updated data in regards to architectural coatings and what that would look like or forecast for our jurisdiction.
Unmute yourself.
Yes, sorry, I had stepped away for a moment. What's the question?
I asked why the emission inventory was 8 years old. It was from 2012, and I was asking if there is not more current data for architectural coatings.
We are working on it. We don't have an updated one yet.
Wow. Whew. Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, just, sorry, to be clear, so we're moving forward with the data from 8 years ago. I mean, again, as you said, this is already kind of a done deal, but it's a little uncomforting to know that there's probably much newer data out there.
This is the data that ARB used to determine what the emissions were from all 35 air districts and to make their report to say, here's the total emissions and this is the percentage out of each air district. And this is what we would anticipate to see reductions from. So we're, you know, it's a suggested control measure for all 35 air districts. And so we're using the data that they use to write their report.
Any other questions?
Oh, yes, this is Spencer.
Spencer.
Hi, I have a question or two. Do I understand right that the reductions we're talking about are for our air district or are they statewide?
We presented specifically for our air district, knowing that we are 2% of the architectural coding inventory of the whole state.
Wow. And I tend to lean towards wanting the environmental benefits, but feel I should probably ask this kind of question. I believe I saw in your report that this doesn't actually directly affect any manufacturers within the air district boundaries in terms of having an impact on their business.
Yes, because we don't, based upon the data that we have, I don't think we have any manufacturers that do blend or repackages here in our jurisdiction.
Right. Does it have impacts in terms of costs likely to go up for contractors and that sort of thing?
I don't know if painting manufacturers will increase their painting costs by implementing these new VOC limits. So
the data was presented in the staff report because there's so many different coatings. There is a range. It could be a reduction to all the way to maybe a couple dollars per gallon. The issue here is, again, we are a South Coast Air Quality Management District. We've already been requiring these VOC limits for several years. So the coatings are already being manufactured. So it's not like somebody who has to go buy a gallon of paint has to buy a new, they're already being sold. So.
Right, right. So clearly, these targets are real. Yeah. So clearly these targets are also realistic.
Yes.
Yeah. And as has been already mentioned, this is essentially, so basically I think our situation is this is happening. These are realistic targets that are already, have already been shown to be met. The direct increases in costs that might be involved are unknown, but they seem like they're within reasonable bounds.
Correct.
So looking at this from the skeptical viewpoint, you know, it seems like this is a pretty reasonable decision.
Any other comments?
I have a question. Go ahead, David.
I'd like to make a correction on the inventory was updated in 2016.
That's good to know. Thank you. I couldn't imagine it being 8 years old. So if there are no other comments or motions in order to recommend proposed rule revisions to Rule 426.
I move to accept the revisions to 46 or 426.
Is there a second to that motion?
A second.
Nope.
So, Anne, do you want a roll call vote?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Let me get that set up on my little electronic here.
Before we take a vote, I actually had one question. I'm just trying to get in. You had talked about the marine anti-fouling paint. There was a span of 100 versus 400. Was there a cost benefit analysis done on that to determine whether we should keep the status quo or look at it further?
Yeah, anti-fouling coatings were removed in the 27 suggested control measure, but when we revised the rule in 2012, Dynegy came and proposed to the advisory committee and the board that they needed that coating. And so the decision was to keep it in. So we kept it in 2012. We went out again to public comment and Dynegy again commented that we still need this. Now the good news is that they gave us the VOC limit of the two materials that they're using. And the highest one was 147. So we could probably come to a compromise and not keep it at 400 and bring it down to 150. But again, if we got rid of anti-fouling, they'd have to meet 100 grams per liter. And they'd probably have to do some extra work to try and find something that is as effective.
So what is the recommendation? Is it to keep it at 400 or move it to 150?
Well, we just received their comment 2 days ago. So I was talking with Amy. I think we will be proposing in the board that we do a compromise and bring it to the material that they are using now, which meets 150.
Okay. Additional questions, Jay?
No, and sorry to interrupt the vote, but no further questions. Thanks.
Okay.
I just want to apologize for my earlier question. I mistabbed and pulled it open to the wrong report. Thank you.
And Janet, if I could just mention a couple of things. The American Coatings Association has reviewed our rule. There was a comment, that's the individual David Darling, who's the executive officer. In addition, I should just say that a lot of these plants, like Dynegy, are really reluctant to give up their old coatings. So it's not like they're probably using a lot of them, but they have them on site and they'd like to be able to use them should they need to. So it's not a big portion of the inventory anyways, but we would probably recommend that compromise.
Okay, the motion is to approve the proposed revisions to Rule 426. Roll call vote.
When I call your name, please answer yes or no. Alan Stroh?
Aye.
Bob Smith?
Yes.
Janet?
I'll go check that one.
Yes.
Jay Tufano?
Yes.
Jeff Davis?
Yes.
Cindy Copeland?
Yeah, I'm going to bring that part.
Okay. Yes.
Great. Yeah,
I know. Andy Swift?
Okay.
And Spencer Critchley.
Yes.
Yes, it's unanimous.
Oh man, this was the one I came up here for too. Well, let's sit down. Sorry. I have to count and remind myself.
There is some.
Yeah, keep the cool air inside.
What did my husband ask me? Oh, I know. When my son and I picked up the plastic table, the thing, it kind of collapsed. I'm going to have my husband try to fix it. But
what was that?
Sandy,
sounds like somebody.
I muted you.
Hopefully, they got the table fixed.
Okay. On to item 7, which is a presentation and provide comments on draft annual AB 2588 air toxic hotspots program report. And this is Amy.
Yes. Good afternoon, advisory committee. Can you see the slides okay, Janet?
What was the question?
Can you see the slides okay?
Yeah, they're so large that they go into my participants panel. I can't see the whole slide.
Okay.
Janet, you can shrink that panel.
Okay.
If you can find the little line, I think everybody's.
Okay, I just did away with it, so.
Okay. So each year we started last year for the first time, we're going to be bringing a report to you about our progress in updating our AB 2588 hotspots program. So I'll give you a little bit more information about what exactly all of that means. I'm just going to start off with talking about what is an air toxics. What's the Air Toxics Hotspots Act that directs us to do this program, and then what our timeline is. So an air toxic has two different meanings. At the federal level, the EPA defines it as something called a hazardous air pollutant, and they're listed in the Federal Clean Air Act. And it's a much shorter list than the state. The California Air Resources Board has toxic air contaminants. And these are chemicals that cause or contribute to an increase in death or in serious illness, or which may pose a threat, present or potential hazard to human health. So these are the two lists of air toxics that we look for. So as an example, I put on the upper right there, benzene is something that you might think of as an air toxic. So the air toxics hotspots, in 1987, the legislature adopted the Air Toxics Hotspots Information and Assessment Act, and that was AB 2588. So you'll kind of see these terms used, AB 2588 or hotspots, and it's all referring to the same thing. And the goals of the act were to collect toxic air contaminant emissions, identify facilities having localized impacts, determine health risks, and notify affected individuals. And the way Rich usually calls it is it was a public shaming act. It was to really get people to do the right thing and reduce their toxics. Otherwise, they're going to have to tell the public about what the, you know, what their emissions are. So what does this AB 2588 require? So facilities report types and quantities of certain toxic substances routinely or predictably emitted, and air districts determine whether or not a health risk assessment must be conducted for the facility. And health risk assessments must be conducted using methods approved by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, and that we call that OEHA. And if after doing that health risk assessment, which is reviewed by OEHA, if there's a significant risk from that facility, then they are required to issue a public notice to those people surrounding the facility and other nearby facilities. And they must prepare and implement risk reduction measures within 6 months of determination that they pose a significant risk. And then they have 5 years to implement those measures to reduce the risk. So we have embarked now on the process of doing this with our facilities. And last year I reported to you on the largest set of facilities we started with, which was about 25 facilities. And so we went through all these, we're working through all these steps with those facilities. And the first thing is to really decide whether a facility is applicable. And I think you'll see there's one facility in the table that we determined was actually not applicable. I think it's one of the small wastewater treatment plants. But in most cases, most sources are applicable to going through the process. And so the first step is to prepare an inventory plan and a report. So the plan identifies, these are all the things at my facility that may emit a toxic emission. And then how am I going to quantify emissions from those potential sources? And then the report tells us what those emissions are. And at the air district, we take that data, that emission inventory data, and we do a prioritization. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. And then so that's where we do that scoring of who has different levels of risk. And that kind of dictates whether you move to this next step where you have to do a health risk assessment, the public notification, and that risk reduction plan. So as I mentioned, applicability is based on annual emissions and source classification. So we follow an inventory guidance document from the California Air Resources Board. And there are, as I mentioned, some facilities that fall out of the first step of applicability, but not many. And then when you get into these inventory plans and reports, we're going to define what is released and from where and how are we going to quantify it. And then the report gives us some more detailed information so that if we need to do a risk assessment, we can. So our first steps are, once we get the plan and the report from the facility, We review all of that, and sometimes there's quite a bit of back and forth. We get that finalized. Then we score the facilities as high, intermediate, or low categories. And that's called a prioritization score. And there's a guidance document that was created by the California Air Pollution Control Officers and the California Air Resources Board that gives us the tools to know how to do that scoring. And so if your score is greater than or equal to 10, you're high. And that's where you get triggered into having to do a health risk assessment. If you're between 1 and 10, you're determined to be intermediate and you're required to report your emissions to us every 4 years. And then if you're low, if your score is less than or equal to 1, then you're exempt from the program and you don't have any of the, you don't have to do any other additional reporting to us until such time that we, you know, if there's a new chemical or as what's happening right now, California Air Resources Board is changing some of the guidelines. So we may have to go back and look at some of the facilities that we've identified as low. So if a facility is determined to be greater than or equal to 10, then they have to prepare a health risk assessment, as I mentioned, within 150 days. And this just is what I just said. Between 1 and 10, you get 4 years, and then that's your timeline for doing your toxics inventory, and then less than 1 is exempt. So if you do the end up with a score greater than or equal to 10, and you do a health risk assessment, you have to be, you have, then you're subject to another set of thresholds when you do your health risk assessment. So for cancer risk, if your health risk assessment results in greater than 10 in 1 million, then you have to do public notification. If your chronic risk or acute indexes result in greater than 1, then you would have to do that public notification. I will say we've had one facility that did have to do a health risk assessment and that scored greater than 10. But when they went and did their health risk assessment, they ended up being below all of the values in this table. So they did not have to move forward with public notification. And in that case, then they're on the 4-year cycle of having to do an emission inventory. So if you do exceed those public notification thresholds, you have to do a risk reduction plan. And you have to audit the sources and come up with a way to reduce emissions so that you can get below those significant risk thresholds. And as I mentioned, you have the facility has 5 years to implement their plan to reduce their risk. So currently, last year, in 2019, the latter part of 2019, we began expanding our list of facilities. And we started with, we added in hospitals, aggregate plants, wastewater treatment plants, and military installations. And we did a workshop in August of last year to go over, we created a spreadsheet to try to help some of the smaller wastewater treatment plants get us the information that we needed to do their assessment. And as I mentioned, CARB is in the process right now of updating their guidelines. And they're adding in hundreds of substances to the list of toxics that we're going to need to look at. And at this time, they're telling us they're planning on taking it to their board in November of this year, along with the criteria emission reporting regulation. So we've been staying in communication and commenting to CARB about both the toxics and the criteria emissions inventory reporting regulation that they're working on. So we have about 6 of those first set of large facilities that we're still working with, and a couple of them have scored high. And so we're working with them to get their health risk assessments completed. And then once those are past our review, we have to send those on to OEHA for review. And so we have two facilities that were in process on doing that. And then the other facilities that I mentioned that we began adding in last year, it's about 80 additional facilities. We'll work on completing those in the upcoming year. And then the California Air Resources Board and CAPCOA are working on an industry-wide guidance for gas stations. And so once that guidance document is done, we'll roll out and be able to do all the gas stations following that guidance. And we're hoping that will be done by the end of this year so we can get started on those as well. So with that, I will take any questions.
I have a question, just out of curiosity. I was looking under your list here that I referred to later at the wrong time, but you've got pretty much all the hospitals listed, but the only one missing on there is Salinas Valley Memorial. I was just kind of curious why that didn't appear on the list.
I may have missed that one. Let's see. Song, do you remember if you've, I'll make a note.
Yes, we should have Salinas Valley Memorial Hospital on there. That could have just been accidentally
yeah, thank you.
Omitted.
I missed it.
Okay.
Other questions?
I have, mostly a comment. My family owns the California Utility Service. They're listed as not applicable under the Assembly Bill 2588, but is this something I should recuse myself from? I guess this is more of a parliamentary question, but.
I think it's just a receive report. I don't think there's any, and provide comments. So I don't think we had requested any kind of action.
Oh, there's no vote? Okay.
Yeah, I don't think, nope.
Perfect, thank you.
Yep.
Other questions?
Well, I still have the one I asked at the wrong time. Is there some way you could kind of interpret that list a little bit better? So I know a little bit more what I'm looking at. The in progresses are pretty self-explanatory, but then, the first couple of pages, it's got, acute scores, chronic scores, cancer scores, those coincide with the intermediate, and is that?
Yes, so those are the ones, let's see if I can, that we've already gotten there. Let's see, I'm gonna try to share my screen again here. Those are for the facilities that we've gotten their emission inventory, and we've put them through our prioritization scoring process. And so those numbers are the numbers that, they're where we're looking at whether or not they're, more or less than 10, what their score is. And so that'll tell you that those are pretty well done. And then it's been decided whether if they're low, they're exempt, or if they're intermediate, they're going to have to report now every 4 years.
Well, some of them on the scores, they had a score like, I'm looking at one here, 2.32. Then it has an E-03 after it. That's where I got a little confused.
Oh, that's the exponent. So that's saying it's actually 0.00. So it's, instead of putting in 0.000156.
Okay, I got you. All right.
You're saying 1.5 E-3, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to just provide clarification on that. The reason why I put those in scientific values was that's the policy for, we have to determine the policy of what's the significant digits that we're going to go to. I didn't want to show that there was simply a zero if we're just going to go to two decimal digits, because then it would just be 0.00. And so I just wanted to be more transparent to the public. It's like, hey, they're very low. It's not, and this is how low it is. Not just putting a big fat zero on there.
Oh, I got you. Now that I'm pointed in the right direction, I thought it meant something else, I wasn't even thinking about math terms.
Any other questions? If not, we will receive and file. Going on to the next presentation, it's a mid-year 2020 engineering and compliance activities. Is that Amy?
Yeah, sorry, you're gonna have to hear from me again. So this is again another report that you we try to give twice a year, just to give an update on kind of how things are going activity-wise in engineering and compliance. So as I'm sure you're all aware, COVID has kind of changed the way we're doing things, even these meetings. And so we've had to adjust our operations for remote work. And we have a crew of inspectors. And so we've had to come up with ways to adjust their work as well. So our first step was to create a remote inspection protocol. And that works really well for things like emergency engines, because the inspector can do that kind of over email or phone, collect information about, you know, how many hours was the engine operated, maybe ask the person to take a picture of the hour meter reading or the nameplate to confirm the engine's still the same. But it doesn't work well for all kinds of equipment. So we've also, in early June, created procedures to allow for some in-person inspections and or complaint responses. And so we're really trying to focus on doing inspections for equipment that's located outside and where we're not going to be, where we're able to maintain the physical distancing from others. So we have made adjustments to our procedures during this time. And so I'm just going to go through basic information about what we do in engineering compliance and then provide some data for you. So on the engineering side, we evaluate permit applications for compliance with federal, state, and local rules and regulations, and issue permits with operating conditions that then go to the compliance side for the inspectors to follow up on a regular basis. And as you heard earlier today from Song, we develop rules and regulations, and we do annual emission inventories and toxics inventories as well. So in engineering, we haven't really seen too much of a drop-off in activity. We are very fortunate. We've been able to maintain our workload. I will mention that we did have an engineer leave at the end of May, and we were directed not to refill that position. So we're down to now three permit engineers. But the numbers that, you know, the number of applications we've received in the first part of this year, so the mid-years, January 1 to June 30, the number of authorities to construct issued, permits issued, we're seeing the same levels that we had in previous years. So that's great. And just so you can have an idea of the numbers of kinds of equipment that we've permitted, we have 1,132 emergency engines. So by far, emergency engines are our number one, the largest percentage of our total permits. We have about 3,000 permits, so about a third of our permits are emergency engines. We have about 223 retail gas stations, 298 paint spray facilities, 200 boilers, and 146 prime engines. So these are the most common categories of permit applications that we get. But I did want to also mention that we do have, we are still seeing some new industry come to our area. Joby Aviation, which is these pictures here that I'm showing you, is a cutting machine. So the picture on the bottom is what the cutting machine looks like on the inside of the building. And then the picture on the top is showing you the dust collection device on the outside of the building. So this is a new source in the Air District, and this is one of the permits that we issued to them, was for this equipment. And then on the compliance side, as they mentioned, our inspectors conduct inspections for the permitted sources. So we follow up and make sure that people are following those conditions that the engineers put on the permits. And if they find that there's problems, they'll take enforcement action for violations of those permit conditions. We also have a staff that do the federal asbestos regulations. So we receive notifications of projects that will be renovating and abating asbestos materials in buildings, for example. And then we also respond to complaints. So on the compliance side, for compliance inspections, we did have a reduction in the number of compliance inspections this first part of the year, because it took a little time for us to get back out into the field and get our remote inspections going and getting people to respond to us. But since July 1, we've seen an uptick and we're back kind of to our normal numbers. So that's very encouraging. Still also saw quite a few asbestos notifications. So those construction projects continued to go forward. The other thing that we've gotten a lot more recently are complaints. And I'm not sure if it's because people are home more and noticing things they didn't notice before, but we have seen a bit of an uptick in complaints. And of course, odor and smoke are our top two types of complaints. And because this data is from January to June, this doesn't include, you know, any wildfire smoke. This is really people complaining about smoke from a neighbor's chimney or from someone burning something in their backyard. And then the odor complaints are wide and varied, but we definitely did see we have been getting more complaints the first part of this year. So with that, I will take any questions.
If nobody else has one, I have just a suggestion that I think on your tables, all of them, it would be more meaningful if you gave maybe the previous 2 years of data to compare with over the similar time period.
Okay.
It would show the impact a little bit more one way or the other.
Sure.
Any other questions? If not, we'll move on to the next agenda item. I think this is a Dave Frisbee a report on ozone and PM10 data.
Share my screen. Can you all see the presentation? Yep. Okay, so this is our mid-year summary for the air monitoring data. So January through June of this year. The district operates 9 air monitoring stations throughout the region.
David, I'm sorry, your presentation just disappeared. It's for me. There we go.
How's that? Okay.
That's great.
I've got two screens going and I have to look back. My camera's on one and my presentation's on the other. So I'm going back and forth. So the district operates 9 air monitoring stations, 3 of which are seasonal. The 6 of the stations are permanent. We operate ozone monitoring at 5 of the stations. With the exception, so of the 6, the exception is up in the San Lorenzo Valley at the middle school. We measure PM10 at Hollister and King City. And if you look over here, Pinnacles National Park operates the Pinnacles Air Monitoring Station. That's, we don't have anything to do with that, although it is used for determining our attainment status for the region. The Park Service operates it for purposes of visibility in the Class 1 airshed. So national parks are considered a Class 1 airshed. Up here in San Lorenzo Valley, we have historically seen higher concentrations, elevated concentrations of PM2.5. as a result of wood burning stoves and fireplaces during the winter months. So that's why we add 3 air monitoring stations to that area for wintertime smoke monitoring. What's not shown here is the wildfire monitoring that we're, the smoke monitoring that we're doing now. We've put out an additional 6 air monitoring stations for measuring PM2.5. And you can see that on our website. This is an example of a couple of our air monitoring stations. You can see that they are large sheds or trailers to house the equipment with sample ports on the outside of the buildings. We also have MET stations where we measure temperature, wind direction, wind speed. And on the inside, you can see that we have our instruments. On the left, you'll see the ozone monitoring device. Not very complicated in the front, but in the back, you can see that the samples go through a series of processes before we can.
You'll need to unlock.
Before the samples are measured. And then on the right, you'll see a particulate sampler. The samples, the measurements are made against the ambient air quality standards. Both California and the federal government have standards for different criteria pollutants. For ozone, PM10, PM2.5, we have different averaging times. There's a 1 hour averaging time and an 8 hour averaging time for ozone and 24 hour averaging for PM2.5 and PM10, which you'll see here the standard for, I'll go back here. So the 90 parts per billion standard for ozone 1 hour is here on this line. This is the state standard for the hourly peak ozone concentrations. As you can see, for the first 6 months of the year, every air monitoring station, each of the counties, is well within the state standard for ozone. For 8 hour, the 8 hour standard is 70 parts per billion, as represented this dotted line here. And you can see that our peak ozone for 8 hours averages are well within the standard of 70 parts per billion. For PM2.5, which is 24 hour average, there's a federal standard for PM2.5, but no state standards. So the 24 hour average for PM2.5 is 35 micrograms per cubic meter. That's represented by this line. And all of our stations have read well below the federal standard for the first 6 months of the year. I'm sure that's going to go up this month. So the end of the year update will have quite a few exceedances of the standard. PM10, you'll see we had one exceedance at the 2 air monitoring stations where we monitor for PM10. King City tends to be the highest concentration. The state standards at 50 micrograms per cubic meter. We exceeded once. Usually we'll start seeing exceedances around May, and between May and October we'll get about 30 exceedances of the state standard. So it's actually, we did have one, but very, very few days of exceedance, or only 1 day of exceedance, so it's rather unusual. We've seen that the last couple of years. So for our attainment status, we're in attainment for all the federal standards. We are in non-attainment transitional for state ozone, because we had one exceedance of the 8 hour standard back in 2018. And we believe that's due to a wildfire smoke blowing in from out of the area. We're at non-attainment for PM10. That's what I was talking about just the slide before, where we have multiple exceedances every year from PM10 at the King City station. And the rest are, we're in attainment for the rest of the criteria pollutants, or unclassified for carbon monoxide in 2 of the counties. But for the region, we're in attainment. I wanted to point out, this is from last year. This is last year's PM10 for both King City and Hollister. And you'll see in October of last year, both of the stations were exceeding the state standard, which is this dotted line here. And the federal standard is up here at 150 micrograms per cubic meter. The Hollister station actually exceeded up to 130 micrograms per cubic meter. And that was a result of a phenomena that we were seeing coming up from the southeastern part of California, maybe Arizona, where PM10 monitors across that part of the state were showing higher concentrations of PM10. And so what's remarkable about this one is it's above 80% of the federal standard, which triggers, unfortunately, the Code of Federal Regulations requires that if we exceed, if we have one exceedance, just one, above the ambient air quality standard, 80% of the standard, we're required to add another station to our the county. And so we share a statistical area with Bay Area. And so the Bay Area AQMD is going to install another air monitoring station. And so we are as well. And so we've done some research and found that we've got access to the San Juan Bautista Elementary School, and we'll be installing a PM10 station there. So with that, I'll entertain any of your questions.
Are there any questions?
Okay. I'm waiting for next meeting. I guess. I want to see what happened.
You want to see those fire statistics, huh?
I want to see the numbers, yeah.
Hi, this is Spencer. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I just had one question, which was, it seems like when we do have these exceedances, it's typically because the air is blowing in from somewhere else. Is that true?
That's typically the case, yes. We are affected pretty significantly by transported pollution from other areas. Unless we have an exceptional event like we're having right now with four fires burning in the region for the past couple of weeks.
Right.
Usually our ozone, the highest concentration of ozone that we historically that we've seen is down at the Pinnacles National Monument. There's our national park. That station down there will receive, it actually just pollutants from the Bay Area. And we've modeled that and have seen that on some days we get really high pressure systems just sitting over the state, and a transport winds from the north, the pollutant soup that comes from the Bay Area cooks in the presence of sunlight and generates ozone. And we see that increase in Hollister and then all the way down into the Pinnacles.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
During the fires, I kept looking at the maps and there were these continual little yellow dots that would show up, and you know, I'd get into a complete panic about what does that mean. Figured it out. They were all district air monitoring stations. The legends on a lot of the fire maps aren't great. So anyway, I'm glad I could figure it out. So I guess there are no more questions. We'll go on to a report from Rich.
Great, thanks, Janet. Okay, advisory committee members. So I'll go through this pretty quickly and you can stop me if there's anything you want further elaboration on. But just on board action, so we've missed the past few months. We did not have a board meeting in July. But in June, we held our second public hearing for a budget, and that was adopted and approved by the board, and that was $21 million or change. I should just add to that that there was no increase to staff wages. There was no increase to fees, and that was both at the direction of the board, and that was primarily due to the COVID crisis at that time. in tandem, we also have to adjust our fee schedule. So you'll see that we held another public hearing to deal with the changes to our fee schedules. And so you can see those areas that are affected there. And you should have received, Ann should have emailed a report out to you. If you don't have a copy, just let me know and I'll get you one. The board also adopted a resolution and approved our Monterey Bay Electric Vehicle Incentive Program. And we have increased the amounts on that. So if you guys are interested, you're eligible. It's a little more attractive this year, part because of COVID. And we didn't have as much demand last year. And we think it's because we got a late start because Monterey Community Power also launched a similar program, which led to some confusion and coordination issues. So they're not doing one this year. So we're the only game in town. And we've upped our amounts, almost doubled them. And if you're a low income qualified candidate, you can actually get that amount doubled. So it's good news for EV adopters in our three county jurisdiction. The board also adopted a resolution approving our new wood stove changeout program. And that's using money that we've gotten from the state. That's about $175,000. And so we're going to be opening that up really shortly here. So hopefully we can start getting those funds out to the public. I know we have some members of our advisory committee that are interested. In August, we also will go through our annual AB 2766. That's our portion that we receive from DMV registration fees. It's $4 per vehicle. And we summarized all the applications received from public entities and provided staff recommendations. The board will be formally adopting those recommendations at the next meeting. And then we did some administrative policy cleanup and dealing with records retention, especially now that we're moving towards more electronic records. And so board approved that. And then the board received the report you received from Amy and David on our engineering compliance activities and on our PM and ozone concentrations. And then this number five there, Monterey Bay Community Power actually contacted me. And this was because when they first came online a couple of years ago, we talked about perhaps combining our offices and having a government center. And it looks like Monterey Community Power, which is now Central Coast Community Energy, they are now or Clean Energy, I forget, it's CCCE or something like that. They are now going to be building a new building out in Marina. And they asked us to come along. They've also asked a number of other agencies. And so it's sort of a weird time to be contemplating this because we just put about $2 million into remodeling the existing facility we're at now. Not that anybody's here, but except for yours truly, so and Amy and others, but we're going to be looking into that. There could be some really nice benefits to sharing a building with Community Power and other agencies, including enhanced government facilities such as a boardroom that could be more accommodating. In addition, it's more centrally located within our jurisdiction and easier to get to. You know, I also sit on TAMC's board, Transportation Agency in Monterey County, and this is about as good as it's going to get on 68. It's only going to get worse. And even if they install roundabouts, it's probably going to not ever get any better than it currently is. So, you know, there's some trepidation and resistance from board members willing to travel the 68 corridor to get here. And AMBAG does not hold their meetings here, even though they are a tenant in our building. So we're going to be looking into that, and I'll be reporting back to the board as more information becomes available. So on the district updates, one thing I didn't write down is we've done a lot of work on COVID at the union's request. We've been developing plans procedures for how we deal with COVID cases, which we have not had any by the way. Staff are very concerned about that. We already put in a lot of safeguards at the building and actually had people start back to work. And then the governor came out with a order to have people stay home again. So we promptly sort of reversed that, and only essential people now come to work here, and that's mainly administrative folks. So we spent a lot of time and effort and resources. Hopefully after this is all over, we can sell a lot of our hand sanitizer on eBay or something. And then of course the biggest thing has been the fire that's preoccupied our time. A number of our staff were actually evacuated, as some of you may have been. It was a scary time. And with respect to the concentrations at our monitors, we got in the dangerous levels at most of our monitors throughout the jurisdiction. So we had basically four fires coming down, sometimes combining smoke concentrations, and it was pretty hazardous to breathe in our area. And that's finally, the last few days has really cleared out, but it was pretty bad for a time. And we've realized there are a number of shortcomings with our air monitoring. They're regulatory in nature. They were never intended to be air monitoring for fires. That's mainly because those are episodic and concentrations can be really high. And our monitors are designed to do 24-hour average. And that happens in an algorithm, and the data gets transmitted to a processing center that processes the data, and then it gets on our website. So maybe even an hour to two delay in publishing those results on our website. So that causes some confusion and consternation with the public, because they can see levels that say they're hazardous, but it seems clear, and vice versa. So I'm going to be proposing to the board, and I'll probably bring this to this committee as well, that next year, in concert with a number of agencies throughout the state, but in this region, we're looking to put together a more rapid response, comprehensive, instantaneous type of monitoring network that would be cost effective, that would give real-time results of air quality experienced at more monitors. For instance, we only have one monitor really in South County right now for PM2.5. And now we found out that farm workers are relying on that monitor as a no-go or no-go with respect to personal protection. So this sounds crazy, but we're advising the public to stay indoors when it gets, the air is unhealthy. But the Cal OSHA is telling farmers that at that point, when it becomes unhealthy, they need to give their workers masks. And they don't have to wear them, they just have to provide them to them. So this has caused a lot of confusion in the public. We had heard about this law last year. It got pushed through really fast by Cal OSHA. And there's some significant contradictions in what we're telling the public and in just public health matters in general. So we'll be working on that as we move forward. Engineering, we also, as Mary and Song said, we've held public workshop on our World 426. It was well attended, it was by Zoom. We've been working on this new criteria and toxics regulation that the state has. We think they've really bitten off too much to chew. It's gonna be very, very difficult for sources to comply with the increase in toxic chemicals and emission inventory data that they need. And we don't think the state has the resources or capabilities to handle all the data at this time. And so we've been commenting on that and working very closely with the state and CAPCOA, the California Air Pollution Control Officers Association. But it's gonna be very, very difficult. We're not really sure why it's being done, because a lot of the chemicals that are listed don't really have any toxicity values and that sort of thing. So it seems to be collecting data for data collection's sake. We also used our hearings board to do a couple permit variances, and that was UC Santa Cruz and Chevron Salinas River Cogen facility. And that's usually as a result of equipment upgrades or repairs. Those were successfully completed and moved forward. As I mentioned about the state, we're actually working on a new database here for our permit system. And that's turning out to be very complicated and complex, but we're moving along, and we're now with a company called Acela, which actually does the database work for Monterey County and all their RMDA permits and that sort of thing. So we're confident that they're too big to fail. Our last contractor ended up not being able to deliver. We had to actually threaten a lawsuit, but we got most of the money back from them for the database system that was never delivered.
Environmental Health is also moving into Acela too.
Yeah, it's a better system. The one problem is it doesn't do emission inventory, so we're probably going to have to purchase another system that will do that, or design another database that will be integrated into Acela. But we think it's the way to go, and sort of wish we had gone that way in the first place. But we're learning. At least we didn't lose money. We just lost a lot of time. And I said the WITSO change program is expected to launch early September, so the next week or so. And then we have a zero emission school bus program. And this is, we used to do clean diesel. Now we're actually changing those diesel buses out to electric buses. And so we've delivered 10 all electric school buses, and six of those were in cooperation with Monterey Bay Community Power, which paid about half of the cost associated with those buses. And they can cost upward of $500,000 to get a school bus. So, We're seeing those getting changed over now, and they seem to be very successful and were greatly appreciated by the district. On outreach, I just want you guys, we have our own YouTube channel now. We've been uploading all of our videos and stuff that we have. We just completed a video on Air Quality Index, which explains the Air Quality Index, and it's in Spanish. And this was at the request of one of our board members, who was having a difficult time explaining to his constituents in South County what the AQI meant. So Ann and one of our staff put together a really great video. So I encourage you to take a look at that. We'll be putting up an English version shortly. We also have a video that we produced on Air Quality 101 with our very own monitoring supervisor, Bill Chevalier, and he goes through and talks about basic air quality issues. We've also implemented a new electronic newsletter. And if anybody ever wants to do an article for that, you're more than welcome to pen something. We're always looking for things to publish of interest in that newsletter. And then we've been doing a lot with reaching out to our IntraVision for Spanish ads. So we've purchased some airtime on these stations to get additional word out to the public on air quality. So it's been a busy past few weeks with the fires and then the COVID thing. I'm just wondering if we're, looking at earthquakes or locusts or something coming up next, but hopefully, I just received, while I was speaking here, an email from the state, and they're going to be doing an alert this weekend, which because of the heat wave that's coming, they call it a flex alert, and they're going to be asking people to switch over to their generators if they have them to alleviate impacts to the grid because they expect to see brownouts. So I guess the good news is at least we don't have a lot of smoke and people using air conditioners and air filtration units because it's hard to run those things without power. And of course, when the air quality is degraded, it seems counterintuitive to tell people to run their diesel and gas-fired generators, but we'll probably see an uptick in that this weekend as well. So that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Okay, let's go on to, thank you, Richard. Let's go on to future agenda items. Any recommendations? If seen none, I have no comments. Are there comments from committee members?
What are the expectations for a meeting next month? Anything at present or?
It'll look to staff. I don't think we have. We have some things in the work for the following month, I believe.
November.
David, Amy.
I think it would be November.
November.
Yeah.
Okay. If there are no other comments, we will. Yes.
Janet's Bob Smith. Agenda was lacking an item for approval of the minutes, and I just kind of picked that up kind of late.
It was a summary of actions, item 5.
Has it been since February?
June.
You typically don't vote on those. Those are just... unless people have issues.
Yeah, just was missing and I thought it was unusual.
Yeah, no, it's item number 5. If you're looking at the right agenda, it's which I know I'm guilty of sometimes. But yeah, it's for the meeting of June 4th.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, there were no comments, so
well, I would like to say, if it had not been for the Air Advisory Committee here, I would have never taken the time to look into HERO. And as of next week, we're going to be completely solar.
Oh, awesome.
So appreciate you guys.
Great. Well, you know, Monterey Bay Community Power is doing a lot as well. And hopefully the energy rates with respect to, electricity are going to be coming down too. And they may have some assistance for solar. It may be too late for you, but hopefully you can get your EV and use your battery to store energy overnight.
That's what we're doing. We're doing it. So we're going to go completely neutral for the most part.
So they may be able to help you with charging at your house from your solar to your car.
Oh, I'll check with them.
Yep.
Thank you.
Richard, I was going to ask you a question earlier, and it completely slipped my mind, but I don't mean to keep you longer here. But, the whole issue of the tipping plants and our own plant in Moss Landing, and, you know, Germany found out a long time ago that they did really well with solar, and so well that they shut down a lot of their plants, and then they ran into the same problem we're running into, is they don't have enough energy in the late evening hours, late afternoon, early evening hours. So I was just wondering, that affects air quality, you know, the longer those plants operate. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, they're operating as peaker plants right now, and that's actually detrimental. It's worse to air quality. I think that Dynegy may go under in the next couple of years, and currently, they're looking at building one of the largest battery backup storage facilities in the world at the Moss Landing site. So that would really make a dent in those being able to store all the excess solar power during the day.
All right. If there are no other questions or comments, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Janet.
Thank you. Thanks to all the staff for really clear presentations.
Thanks, Spencer. Have a good one.
You. Stay safe, everyone.